Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
When I pull up to the parking lot, it's time to level up. Dial in, showing out for your team. Listen up, get you some. I stand the fan to give you what you need. Fan fuel, game time. Turn up the intensity. Team colors bleeding now. 5 hour energy. For a limited time, get the fan fuel flavor at 5hourenergy.com.
Sports Radio 610 presents Seth Payne and Sean Pendergast.
We've come to eighth time. Let's get to work in, man. Let's go.
Great day, great day. Oh, give me some juice, baby.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How do we start that on Friday morning at 6 o'clock with a little football music? Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast this morning, and still with us is former Houston Texan badass Seth Payne. Gary producing. What? You are?
Thank you.
Absolutely. Hey, look, after all of the stuff that we've seen from former players on both sides of the ball over the course of this past week with the Azeez Al-Shaire takes, I'm not going to look at you sideways, dude.
Azeez Al-Shaire should have been afforded 3 more seconds to hit Trevor Lawrence. You should be allowed to pummel him while he's on the ground. That's what you get. That's what you get if you're a late slider, I'll tell you.
It's the way we played the game. We've got to talk. Man, I loved all of that. You know, back in my day, like conversation, that was like, your day was literally like, I don't know, you retired like 5 years ago with some of the takes from some of the guys that we've heard over the course of this past week.
That's the whole thing. I feel like we've shied away from, I don't think we've hit the whole back in my day part of it because it's just useless. Okay, the game has changed, it's evolved, and the rules are the way they are. I think the whole thing with the Azeez Al-Shaire debate, as you and I were discussing it before the show, is there's so many different aspects and facets to it that it's almost impossible to not get into an argument about it, even if it's somebody that you think you agree with, because you might start off with like, well, yeah, it's hard to make a decision in that moment, and then somebody says, yeah, it's really on the quarterback, this, and then, wait, hold on a second, it's not on the quarterback. There's just so many different, and that's why people keep getting continually angry over it. The last 3 days, I've come in every morning, and I've said, listen, I can't be angry about this forever. We have to move forward, and then somebody will say something that triggers me.
Yeah, well, you know what? Now we know we have a little bit better of an understanding of what goes on in some of these meetings in the off season, like the rule change committees. And you wonder why literally every NFL off season they come up with like a half dozen to a dozen different rule changes that need to be enacted this season. So I never feel like we get a good grasp of what anything is. You remember we went through that good portion of what felt like about a decade of, hey, what's a catch again? You know, that whole thing. And now it's, I thought the biggest issue was going to be, boy, this targeting thing, the helmet to helmet. Now it's literally still the quarterback. How can we protect them even more? Does every quarterback out there need to look like the dorky dude on Little Giants? I don't know. Maybe. But even if he did, your ass still needs to like get out of bounds and not dive or slide or anything anymore.
You know what? I'm glad you put it that way. In terms of just, okay, what's the controversy of the day? Because I guess in hindsight, it makes sense that this is going to be the controversy because there are so many dual-threat quarterbacks in the league now. It didn't happen all that quickly, but
no, there was a conversation that existed, like, these guys will never last.
right.
Pocket passers.
Let's say when the zone read first hit the NFL with Colin Kaepernick, and some of those quarterbacks, Russell Wilson, from those, when the college game really started infiltrating the NFL game and the way it was played, that's kind of when it was, you could mark that as the beginning of, okay, this was going to be inevitability. You got quarterbacks running all over the place all day long. I mean, the chances of like a Tom Brady level athlete making it in the NFL these days as a young quarterback, it's just less and less and less likely. Teams have gone from looking side-eyed at athletic quarterbacks to now it's a prerequisite. So we're gonna have more situations like this, and when you try to protect, it's almost like you're trying to protect a bullet from hitting its target. Like, okay, how do we protect this bullet? Yeah. Well, it's moving through space. Don't hit it. Don't hit it. Yeah. As long as the bullet says, "I'm done. I'm done." Yeah.
My brother-in-law actually had a very brother-in-law type of analogy yesterday. But you know what?
No.
I actually looked at him and I was like, you know what? From the NFL's perspective, this actually makes a little bit of sense because they're stupid. It's like, you know, we're over there, like, getting ready to order breakfast tacos yesterday morning, and he's like, you know what? Like, he's trying to explain to my wife, you know, the whole Aziz Alshire thing, it's like, you try to run full speed at that wall right there, and then stop, like, 2 feet before the wall and try not to hit the wall, and I'm like, yeah. I get what you're saying, bro.
Well, the whole thing, honestly, and I'm going to be as objective as possible today without letting my natural self take over. But there is that part. The part that's bothered me the most in terms of the discourse on the national shows and everything else is how casually people will just say that Aziz was targeting Trevor Lawrence's head, or that he hit his head, which is just untrue. You know, like, if you watch it at all, that's just completely untrue. Now, you get the other part of it too, and this part I get a little bit when they say, okay, he led with his forearm. The problem in a situation like that is if you don't lead with the forearm in that instance, Aziz's torso probably hits Trevor Lawrence's head.
Or helmet to helmet.
Or helmet to helmet.
Yeah,
right.
There's more reality for the helmet to helmet situation there.
Once Aziz commits to trying to tackle Trevor Lawrence, and once Trevor Lawrence is committed to the slide, there's not a lot Aziz can do. And the fact that he didn't hit Trevor Lawrence's head perhaps was the, even though people are still describing it like he hit his head, that might have been the saving grace in terms of it not being like a record-setting suspension or something. Mm-hmm. But that's you're splitting hairs on that, but that's what all of this is about. It's all splitting hairs. Hey, I'm watching Stephen A. Smith. We'll play some of the audio later of Stephen A. Smith.
It's gonna be great.
Talking about, they treated Casario's comments like Casario was saying that Aziz shouldn't have been suspended at all, which is, that's flat out untrue.
Yeah.
Casario, without saying it explicitly, everything he said seemed to read that, hey, it's the 3-game suspension, not the suspension. Not that there was a suspension, but it was a 3-game suspension.
There's so much to unpack here. Like, and I know you and Sean have basically done this. I mean, here it is Friday. He's taking the day off. But, I mean, I've only had 2 shows this week. You guys have done 4. This will be your 5th. And I still feel like we could do...
And I'm looking forward to getting your perspective on it, too, because you know, we get in our own little silo.
I told you this before the show, and you were like, yeah, you know, and still what people want to kind of talk about, even though maybe a lot of people are kind of tired of it, and maybe we're tired of talking about it. I'm like, no, I am not. Like,
oh, good.
I've only had 8 hours this week to get into it, and it's as heavily opinionated as both me and PC are, especially on this particular topic. I feel like there is a full rack of ribs left, you know, of meat on the bone. So I'm really, and you know, think about it like this too. We're almost a full week removed from the impassioned opinions and how we felt immediately about the hit, about the melee, about the aftermath, about, you know, Jags people, radio hosts weighing in on their thoughts of everything. You took all that in, and maybe today, Ron Hughley's ass will effectively pull his head out of his and see if he can maybe change to somewhat of a logical opinion on the matter. So wait and tune in from 2 to 6, and maybe you'll hear that from him. But we'll try to get him there. And I want to see what your perspective is, how it's maybe evolved. And mine really hasn't.
Yeah.
But I do want to share with the people what it actually was initially and what it is now.
Yeah, tell me what you're, because Ron, I guess the two spectrums would go, Ron has been the most critical of D'Amico and Nick and Alshire himself and everybody else.
If you haven't heard, let me just, you want to know what Ron said? What do you think the guy said that hails from Kansas City, whose quarterback is Patrick Mahomes and who has been uber protected for the last 7 years by all NFL referees as, like, you know, the golden boy? Like,
and who also fake slides a good amount.
Yeah. So what do you think his opinion was?
That Aziz Alshire is a monster, and if this had happened to CJ Stroud. No, I know Ron's opinion. I'm just intrigued by it. So
I am too. It's weird.
And I think there's room for... I mean, this is the thing. And honestly, this is why we were wondering yesterday why this story seemed to have gained so much traction nationally. Mm-hmm. It's because there are valid opinions on both sides, and it's a murky area. And whenever things are murky, same thing happens in constitutional law. Like some of the constitution, the amendments that are kind of murky and written, and it seems like Madison might have been drunk when he wrote it, which was a possibility back in the day. Those guys drank a lot.
Of course. That's
when there's a lot of room for discussion and heated debate. And now you involve head injuries into it, and it just amps it up that much more.
Well, sure, and you can't have those discussions usually, even sometimes at 6:10 in the morning, without being a little inebriated. Not saying that I am or you are, but, you know, wouldn't put it past us. I mean, they do keep a full liquor cabinet here. So it is what it is.
I think Madison was a Quaker, though. I'm not sure. Half those guys were Quakers back in the day. He probably wasn't drunk.
Well, I mean, snake oil? I don't know.
That's true. I think a lot of them were there, as it has been throughout history. There are a lot of public teetotalers who are sipping on the old cough syrup at night.
Yeah, absolutely. He's Seth
this
Payne.
Isn't alcohol, it's cough medicine.
I'm Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. Let's give you the digits, man. Be a part of the show this morning. We've got you till 10. 713-572-4610. 572-4610. You could call or text the 5-Hour Energy fan line. 5-Hour Energy, the official energy shot of Sports Radio 610 and football super fans. And I don't know if you get this shout out very much, but you, sir, are a always entertaining follow on Twitter. So in case you are new to the show, a lot of people may be fresh in town for the holidays. Check Seth Payne out at Seth C. Payne on Twitter, at Sean Bajani for myself, Twitch and YouTube. You can watch and join the chats there as well. I don't know if you caught any of the Thursday night football game last night. I caught most of the second half, and I don't know, for me, my money, that seemed to be the best part of it, with another incredible finish. We're going to get to that, and more on that subject, Seth. We're going to discuss what maybe made you and fans out there jealous after having watched everything that went down with the Detroit Lions and Green Bay Packers on Thursday night football. We'll do that next. It is Sports Radio 610. Stay put.
It's a football Friday on Sports Radio 610. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
Yeah, football Friday, Sports Radio 610. Payne and Pendergast in for Pendergast. I'm Sean Bajani along with Seth Payne. Ben Gary producing. We've got you till 10 o'clock this morning. So Thursday night football last night, Seth. I don't know how much of a game you actually had a chance to catch.
I went back and watched the 15-minute highlight reel from YouTube. That's what I usually do for the late games.
That's money. That's money. Yeah. You know, I generally have to do that for Thursday night football because, you know, I have the NFL Plus subscription, but I don't utilize it, nor am I able really to utilize it on a weekly basis. You know, I got a 4-year-old, and I got to keep him entertained. And,
well, you know, the trouble though is that the way I think they just have AI basically pluck out the relevant plays,
definitely
what it thinks are the relevant plays. But when you go back and you watch even the condensed version, where it's every single play and it's about 40 minutes long, usually. It's weird because sometimes they'll show the referee's explanation and everything. But for instance, when Trevor Lawrence got hit by Aziz Alshire in the condensed version, it was like there was the hit, then on to the next play. Hey, look, there's Mac Jones. You're like, whoa, you would have zero clue what happened. Yeah.
There needed to be like a little subsection at least, like you could click on. You want to see the melee. Number one, and then number two, like click here or something like that.
Yeah. But you'd have zero understanding you wouldn't even know it was a big deal. You'd be like, oh, Trevor Lawrence must have gotten hurt, I guess. Okay.
So to me, look, there was a lot of action in this game last night. The Lions beat the Packers 34-31. Another down to the final second, literally thriller last night. The Lions getting a field goal as time expired to beat the Packers. One of the most interesting things to me, and this is what Dan Campbell is, This is who he has been. This is what he does. But Seth, last night, it was executed to perfection. I mean, the brass balls on this guy is just amazing. I love it. I mean, it was fourth and inches. I don't know. The running back, I think, tripped or whatever it was on the third down.
Yeah. And
so he doesn't get the first down. They're inside the 25, maybe inside the 20, I think, if memory serves. And so it's fourth and inches with like 40 some odd seconds left, maybe inside 40. And instead of like kicking the field goal and giving Jordan Love and the Packers like a little bit of time, a little bit of faith, hope, and all of that stuff to maybe go down and do the same thing, if in fact the Lions would have made the field goal at the time, Dan Campbell's like, psh, hell nah. I am not giving Jordan Love the freaking football again. We're going to go. And everybody thought they were just trying to draw him off sides because they had the timeout to burn. Mm-hmm. And so they get up to the line and they wait a few seconds and they set a guy in motion. And I'm like, holy bleep, they're going to run a play. They ran a play and freaking Goff trips, stretches, hands the ball out, and they get the first down. And I'm like, holy smokes, they just did this thing. Now you just got a little chip shot of a field goal. And sure enough, they got it and they won.
That's, and I'll tell you too, the execution of that, even though there was a stumble on the execution of it, as a defensive lineman in a fourth and one situation, the stressful part is that you know they might be trying to bait you offsides. Happened to the Texans last week when the young defensive tackle jumped offsides. And so you're stuck in this world of like, man, if they're going for it, I got to go as hard as I've ever gone in my entire life. But they know that, and they're going to bait me into it. So just kind of delaying it a little bit and making it feel like it was going to be it plays so many head games with you. And both those teams last night, there's so many examples in that game where, offensively especially, I was just jealous of like, okay, oh, this is a fine-tuned machine.
Yes.
I think DeMeco Ryans has the stones to go for it on fourth and short in those situations. But I don't trust that the offense can actually pull it off.
100%. And, you know, DeMeco Ryans, this year in particular, I think I felt that way more so early this season. Like, you know what? It's fourth and short. Like, if he's kind of like beyond his own, 38-yard line, like, he trusts his defense, and the defense has been damn good enough to where, you know what? Yeah, we're going to go ahead and do this thing. We're going to go for it. And he did this a little bit last year, and I think that's where people were really like, yeah, let's go, because you want that toughness, you want that confidence from your coach and your team, and I think he's absolutely got that this year. That's been a little bit become tepid now because of the inefficiencies of the offense.
No, I think you're exactly. That's what I was wondering if you're going with that, because it does. It feels last year, it felt like he made more decisions in which you wouldn't say, oh, that's a defensive-minded head coach.
Yes.
This year, it feels way more like they're willing to settle for a field goal or what have you. And part of that, I think, is honestly that I don't think he trusts the offense. I mean, it's just he flat-out doesn't trust the offense. And then the defense, when it does, you can't 100% trust the defense. As good as they've been, they've just allowed these huge chunks and critical moments too often.
We'll talk about that a little bit later. It's funny that you say that and have that opinion. Like, you can't trust the defense. You might say I trust the defense way too much after I tell you my take where I think this team is at right now into this bye week. But we'll get to that a little bit later on. You talk about being jealous of things in the game last night. I mean, there was a lot. It's just, you watch the Lions play and how they execute the offense. I mean, how could you not be jealous? There's a lot to dive into. Maybe you have some more specific thoughts, but one of mine is literally that last play, Seth, as you mentioned. You know, they stumbled to it. They ended up executing it. They got the first down on the fourth and inches, and they kicked the field goal. They win the football game. Clock management this time for Dan Campbell and the Lions worked out amazingly. I mean, it couldn't have been better executed. But that's one of the things that I'm very jealous of, is just in those moments, critical moments of games. It could be in the first half for the Texans where they need to go down and respond to a score late in the first half, or something in late in the third quarter where, you know what, you've got an opportunity to create a little momentum for yourself home, especially on the road going into the fourth quarter, to get points on the board, make a stand, whatever. What the Texans have not been able to do, and I hate these damn bunch sets that they run, where they bring everybody into the box, they allow the defense to pin their ears back in big-time moments, whether they're trying this BS hurry up crap or not. The Lions did it last night. They took their time because they could take their time. And even though with the stumble, I don't know what that play really looks like if he doesn't stumble, but it's probably a little bit of a stretch play to the right. With motion, with pre-snap motion, that's what I want to see from the Texans offense in those moments, is creating a shadow of a doubt, a millisecond of freeze by a linebacker, by a safety, by a defensive end that, I don't know if I should go here, and then boom, it's too late.
I think that both of those teams, one of the big differences between them and the Texans is that defenses have to respect the run game. And a lot of the things I'm watching last night, and I'm watching a lot of the easy yardage they get in the passing game, both with, Jordan Love got off to a really slow start. He had like 40-some yards passing in the first half. But with the Lions, especially early on, you see like, oh, where are all these easy plays with the Texans? Where are these crossers over the middle? Oh, these screens, they're so well executed. Look at the offensive line just getting out in space and attacking guys downfield and actually making contact with defenders. Mm-hmm. All of those things, the short game, whether it's the run game or screens, the defenses have to respect it. And because of that, it creates opportunities downfield. And that's where the run game and the pass game complementing each other, they just have not been able to get it going offensively the way the teams like the Lions and the Packers have. At the same time, the part that I'm like keep reminding myself is, hey, these are two teams that the Texans slugged it out with.
Yeah.
And you know, I think the Packers are still very much in that conversation of a team that could do damage in the postseason. But they're both more well-balanced teams, obviously. They're both further along in their development than where the Texans are right now.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the reasons that we were really kind of intrigued and excited about Bobby Slowick and, you know, the offense that he was going to be bringing in with the Houston Texans, obviously, you know, stemmed mostly from like, hey, well, you know what, he's a Shanahan guy. And you guys have come up with the, fantastical, you know, moniker, the name, like the Coop Shanistan offense, right? Love that. But one of the reasons I was excited is, hey, this guy's got experience on the defensive side of the ball and, you know, transition to offense. And D'Amico, with the way that he's just able in real time to identify things and pick up on keys that the defense is looking at offense, is like how much that guy could help in the course of a week in a meeting room and maybe on the sideline. And you talk about, boy, yeah, look, Jordan Love last night, we'll take him for instance, be able to kind of settle in and adjust and figure some things out and find the easier plays in the second half to get back into this game against Detroit. I wonder, you know, if that's something the Texans can actually pivot to. And you could speak to this. You've been in the defensive meeting rooms and you've been on teams that have struggled and made adjustments and had and gone on runs in the second half of seasons. But if there's something they can do this week and maybe even just this offseason, if it comes to that, where they get somebody else on that offensive side of the ball that's just as defensive-minded as maybe D'Amico, that could really help Bobby Slowick and maybe Ben McDaniels in that passing game, who's their pass game coordinator, identify keys quickly, maybe in real time, and be able to adjust the offense where they can find those easier routes. They can expose what safeties and backers are doing.
You know what? That's really interesting because in my mind, I think the solution is right in front of you. And it's that one of the biggest problems with the Texans offense right now is that the actual defensive coordinator, D'Amico Ryans, is holding the offense back by being a defensive coordinator. And some teams will call it red teaming. It's based on old Cold War terminology where you have a red team that basically tries to pick out the holes or see what the weaknesses are in the game plan.
Yeah.
So they'll have a red team that looks at Bobby Slowick's offense and or his game plan and thinks, okay, this is how I'd attack that, all of that. D'Amico Ryans is a great resource in that regard, and I'm sure they do some level of that. But in the game, when D'Amico's very, very heavily involved in the defense, that's where I wonder, okay, man, this could be time when he could be kibitzing with Bobby Slowick and the offensive coaches on the sideline and figuring out, hey, this is what's going on, this is where they're seeing your weaknesses, all of that. Because in the Jags game, it's versus a bad defense, but in the first half, the run game wasn't working at all. Joe Mixon was averaging less than 2 yards per carry for most of the first half.
Yeah.
They figured it out in the second half. They moved more over to a gap scheme. They started attacking over, running behind Laremy Tunsil, having Cade Stover as a blocker, all of that. That worked out really well. And it was a, it was one of the only times this season where we've seen, hey, look, they tweaked their play calling a little bit and it worked. So, yeah, that part of it, I think ultimately for this team to really get to where it needs to go, D'Amico's got to become more of a genuine head coach that can see both sides of the ball because he has that brain for it. I just, it's allocation of resources and gray matter right now. I think might be yes. holding Bobby Slowick back a little bit.
Yeah, I think allocation of resources right there. I mean, you know, D'Amico, you know, we've heard numerous times now, like the guy's in all the meeting rooms. He's very active in all facets of this football team, which you would expect. And that also is, that speaks to his ability to manage multiple different things. But yeah. in the course of a game, I just, there's maybe another guy or two. And maybe it's going to come to a point to where D'Amico maybe turns things a little bit over more to Matt Burke, where he can, you know, focus a little bit less in game on defensive things and kind of has this ship, this defense at least, well oiled enough to where he believes Matt Burke can, you know, think how he thinks, react how he wants to react in certain critical moments. I just always go back to that that playoff game last year against the Browns where, you know, you see the highlight and he pulls Christian Harris over and he tells Harris exactly what is going to happen.
It's right.
Like, you need to stay home here. You yeah. know, don't bite. Just stay put. And they're going to throw the ball right here. And then,
yep.
damn it, if they don't.
And he called the pick six.
He called it.
He was like Babe Ruth pointing out the home run.
And
yeah.
so, like, if you're able to identify stuff like that, and look, sometimes that stuff is easy. It really is. Right. Like, you've played football. If you've coached football, you can just kind of pick up on little things, and you just know.
And, yeah, that was, you know what, and that's where you see that on defense where you don't necessarily see it on offense. All of that was predicated on understanding the way that Joe Flacco responded to a look earlier in the game,
yeah.
the defense they had shown.
Yes.
So they showed the exact same look, but then they rotated the coverage. They dropped the backer into a backer that looked like he was blitzing off into coverage, and Flacco took the bait. And so, yeah, so you lose that perhaps if D'Amico Ryans isn't heavily focused on the defensive side of the ball, but you're also still losing things offensively. I think if D'Amico's not doing what the job of a head coach is,
yeah.
which is to get the absolute most out of your assistant coaches. That's what I always admired about Belichick. I loved watching him interact with his position coaches. And then you would see shots of, you know, Belichick interacting with offensive linemen or interacting with various offensive players. That's not his expertise or anything, but he's got a perspective on it that first and foremost, Belichick got the assistant coaches to be really good assistant coaches.
Yeah.
And then some other poor team in the league would think, oh, this guy would probably be a good head coach, too.
Hey,
and you, like, no. He was just an awesome assistant coach under the tutelage of Bill Belichick.
You've seen the Belichick footage, I'm sure, that I'm about to reference. But one of my favorite clips of Belichick over the years coaching is in the earlier days with Tom Brady. I mean, he was a badass at that point in time. But, you know, they come over after a spoiled drive and Belichick's like, well, why didn't you, you know, throw the ball over to this guy? And Brady's like, I did. You know, it went over his head. Like, it, you know what? And he's like, well, no, the other one. It's like, they hit him in the hands. And Belichick's like, no, the other one. And he's like, no. And Brady's like, oh, that one. You know, Belichick's like, yeah, you know, it could have been a better throw. I love that stuff. And it's just, you know, you see the clips of him in the office and, you know, they're going over offensive game plan and stuff like that. Belichick's very well versed on both sides of the ball, and we all know that.
He might be the University of North Carolina head coach next year.
He's coming up next in our headline segments.
Right,
we've got to get to that. So Belichick there, a Rockets spoiled game last night, and the Astros offering Alex Bregman insult or not. We'll have that and much more coming up next. Payne and Pendergast, it's headlines. Stay put.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines.
And for Payne and Pendergast, I'm Sean Bajani. Seth Payne's still here. It is headlines, and the first we've got today is the Rockets. Boy, they lost a tough one last night to the Golden State Warriors, and people were frustrated watching this. I was kind of tracking it on social. Houston lost last night 99-93, Seth. The Warriors snapping a five-game losing streak. which was a very gettable game for the Rockets. And I think for a lot of fans, myself included, after watching the Rockets easily with their most impressive victory this past weekend, get that dub against Oklahoma City, and then coming off of the most impassioned game that I can recall, with both Ime Udoka and Alperen Şengün getting tossed against the Kings the other night, I felt like people in this team and Udoka himself was expecting that to be sort of a galvanizing moment. And, well, he ended up calling the team soft. In fact, not just soft, but he said last night's defeat was one of the softest games that he's seen them play. And I can't disagree with them. In a game that they lost by six that did not feature Steph Curry or Draymond Green for the Warriors.
Right, right. This is what that was the biggest surprise to me, was that, you know, Udoka called them soft. And I'll get to that in a second, but I expected to be a grittier effort out of this team that hasn't lost back-to-back games all year. It's demonstrated their toughness, their grittiness defensively. And they come right out the gate and remind you, oh, yeah, they are one of the worst shooting teams in the league. They start off 2-for-16 and yet don't really battle back from that. The fact that Udoka said they were soft, but that Van Vliet basically said, yeah, that's fair and accurate. I like that. Because, look, we saw earlier this year when the Patriots, when Gerard Mayo called his defense soft, it turned into this big whole rigmarole about, oh, I can't believe he called his defense soft. All right, man, look, if the players are willing to accept the criticism, and if it fits a little bit, then call them soft. It's not like you're insulting their dead mother or something. I like the fact that Van Vliet co-signed Udoka's assessment of the game.
I think it's a really good point. I think it's very important, and it's going to be understated. There's not going to be the proper amount of attention paid to it because, well, look, it's basketball, and it's boom, on to the next. The Rockets play the Clippers on Sunday. And then, you know, you get a rematch with the Golden State Warriors on December 11th. That's Wednesday. So in less than a week, you're going to see these guys again, probably at full strength. And that's going to be a TNT game. So big game. And the reason why I say that is, like, hey, this is a team that, you know, came out of the gate, like, pretty damn hot. They had won, like, 8-10 at one point before these last couple of losses to the Kings and the Warriors. And they know what's going on, and for one of your veterans, for one of your leaders to co-sign what the coach is saying, I already know. We should already be able to identify that this team is taking on the personality, and has now for some time, going back to last season, the personality of their coach. And he's got the vibe, he's got the pulse, and for one of your leaders to say, yep, you know what, he's right, that in and of itself should be a galvanizing, you know, element to propel this team going forward, because the schedule is going to start getting tougher as the season goes along, Seth. And I think it is huge that they've been able to stack wins and position themselves as well as they had right now. Now they have to make it pay off.
Right, right. And look, your young guy, like Jalen Green was, 4-for-16 last night?
Yeah.
Şengün's been struggling for a few games now. You know, he's last night he was he's averaged 5.2 points on 34.2% shooting over the last six games. So your young guys, and what do they develop into over the next, you know, the remainder of the season is obviously going to be a key thing versus tougher competition. But that was a bit of a shocker to me, especially when you're facing a team down a couple, it's two studs that you come out and kind of played, I don't want to say play down to the competition when it's the Warriors, except that you're playing down to that version of the Warriors.
Yeah. Up next on headlines, the Astros reportedly have an offer in to Alex Bregman. You know, we heard this report about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I think Bob Nightingale had something. John Heyman had something. It was confirmed to MLB.com this week that the Astros offered Alex Bregman a six-year deal worth around $156 million. Brian McTaggart had a nice write-up on MLB.com yesterday. According to him, that would be a club record contract for the team in terms of dollars, but Bregman is believed to be seeking a deal closer to the $200 million mark, which likely, as McTaggart says, would price the Astros out and force them to move on from their cornerstone third baseman. Is this more of a insult type of offer, do you think, for Alex Bregman, or do you feel like there's a segment of Astro fans that believe this is just about right and what Bregman should be getting?
It was interesting because it ran the gamut, you know, from people that thought that was an insult somehow to people that thought, like, oh, there's, you know, he should totally 100% accept that. It's $5 million more than the deal Matt Chapman got from the Giants in September.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the comp that people have been using. I think that, and he shares the same, they both are Boris clients, you know, so Chapman signs with his own team, you know, for an extension. Chapman's 1 year older than Bregman, so you might argue that, hey, with, you know, adjusted for inflation and you know, 1 year younger, that seems like a fair deal. So I don't think it's an unfair deal whatsoever. This is where you hope that, I don't want to call it a hometown discount, but I think what happens when a team negotiates with its own player, with a homegrown player, doesn't necessarily have to be a discount, but when you come to the negotiating table, you can have a little bit more, it's more of a like a win-win negotiation. Mm-hmm. You can have maybe more of a dialogue of like, hey, these are our concerns, this is what we'd like to do. The player can say, I understand your concerns, this is what my goals are, and it becomes, it's less of a bidding war, less of like a, you know, purchasing a car where a lot of it's just going to be, this is what I'm going to pay, this is what I'm going to pay. You can have more of a win-win negotiation. This makes sense. If I'm Alex Bregman looking at this, this makes sense from the Astros side of things. If you understand their, look, they're, it's the Astros' own fault, but they got a whole lot of dead money from guys that aren't going to play on the team this year. The contracts of various guys who are still out there. And then, I mean, including Lance McCullers contract, which who knows whether
he's coming back.
Yeah.
Come on.
So I think they can work with this. I think there's a – I feel more optimistic. And I know we've been talking about these numbers. Now that the I feel like – maybe another good sign is that the reports were already out about this contract, but the fact that it's public discourse now and actual, like, you know, transparent makes it feel like, all right, maybe they're operating and negotiating in good faith. So I'm 60% optimistic that Bregman's going to be back.
Oh, 60% optimistic. 60%
optimistic.
I look at it like this. This is the offer, okay? And Crane has said this multiple times. They operate like a business.
Yeah.
And so this is the offer. Now it's Boris's turn to counteroffer. And who knows if that hadn't already happened and just hadn't broken yet, because these figures in both years and monies had been out there unconfirmed for about a week and a half to 2 weeks now. So maybe there's conversation ongoing. Maybe there's been multiple counteroffers already. I just want to see those reports. The one thing that I felt like the Astros could not do is be insulting to Alex Bregman this offseason.
Right.
For many reasons, but look, for what we can see and feel and understand as media and the fan base, most importantly, is you wanted to feel like one of the greatest players in your franchise's history was respected this offseason because he deserves it and could not be insulted with a non-competitive offer. And to be quite frank, I don't think 6 years, albeit a record offer, I don't think is really competitive in terms of the money. If the Astros are able to counter offer and we get that report, I think we can feel better about it, even if Bregman and Boris decline and move on elsewhere.
Okay, from the Astros' perspective, and again, remember that Altuve and Bregman share an agent in Scott Boris.
Yeah.
And people always feel like, oh, Scott Boris is going to push his guys to free agency. They've done this twice with Altuve, where they've extended him with Scott Boris as his agent to keep him on the same team. It's a little bit higher than Altuve's contract. And Altuve's contract is structured in such a way that it's very team friendly.
Yes.
It's, you know, it's front-loaded. He makes less money later in his career. And I think the Astros can say, I think without being sneaky or sly about it or anything, hey, this is the biggest contract we've ever offered. This is stretching for us in the way we operate. We are, with the constraints that we've put on ourselves as an organization, this shouldn't be perceived as an insult by you, at least. This is it's a 6-year deal. It's 1 year more than we've offered ever on an extension. So I'm not worried about the emotional part of it. I'm not worried that Bregman's going to feel insulted, especially because Boris is the same guy that did the Chapman contract and did the Altuve contract.
He's Seth Payne, and in for Sean Pendergast this morning. I'm Sean Bajani. That's going to do it for headlines. We'll get to the Belichick, and there's actually some other college football coaching news to share with you. We can get to that a little bit later on in the show. Let's circle back to the Texans coming up in the 7 o'clock hour and what we really need to see happen for this Texans team to improve this final stretch run. We've all had it circled on the calendars all season long. They're about to hit the gamut with the Dolphins and the Chiefs and the Ravens and finishing out the season with the Titans. What is the best version that we need to see of this team the final month coming up? We'll get to that next at Sports Radio 610.